Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of React Native Radio. Today, joining us will be me, Tim Jung, and Ricky Romero. Do you want to introduce yourself, Ricky?
Hey, what's up, guys? My name is Ricky Romero. I'm a software engineer at Activision Blizzard. I work on their companion app on using React Native with Tim. And yeah, it's pretty fun working there.
And joining us today, our guest will be Will Gant. And Will, do you want to introduce yourself too and just kind of give us the high-level overview of why you're talking to us today?
Sure. My name is Will Gant. I'm half of the Complete Developer podcast. I recently wrote a book that's coming out at the end of this month on remote work, specifically how to convince your boss to let you do it and then how to do it effectively. Obviously, with the current scenario going on in the world right now, remote work has become more important than ever. So that's kind of why I'm on the podcast.
Early in my career, I figured out which jobs were worth working at and which ones weren't, mostly by trial and error. I created a system that I used to find jobs and later contracts as a freelancer. If you're looking for a job or trying to figure out where you should go next, then check out my book, The Max Coder's Guide to Finding Your Dream Developer Job. The book walks you through figuring out what you want, vetting companies that meet your criteria, meeting that company's employees, and getting them to recommend you for a job. Don't settle for whoever has listed their job on the job board. Go out and proactively find the job you'll love. Buy the book at devchat.tv/jobbook. That's devchat.tv/jobbook.
Awesome. Sounds perfect. Yeah, definitely kind of, by the time this airs, it'll be a little later now and the situation might be a little different. But yeah, right now we're all working from home and a lot of developers out there are working from home, just kind of because of what's going on with COVID in the world. So I definitely think we'll have a lot of questions for you, about that, what that means coming out of your book and everything. So yeah, it's a good topic and that's a good time to, dive into this and get some tips on how to be successful working from home.
Yeah, me and Tim were actually talking before you came on. I was like, I'm kind of enjoying working from home right now. Like I feel like I get more stuff done. But I'm like, okay, so if when we start going back to work, like how do I convince my boss to like let me maybe like work from home like 4 days out of the week? Like how would you strategize that?
Yeah, actually I get into that in the book, again from pre-plague times. The big thing is setting up a reasonable, test case, which we already have, right? We've all been working from home for the duration of this entire virus. But previously, it would be like, hey, I've got a veterinarian appointment for my dog, or I have a doctor's appointment, and it's close to the house. I need to be there, so can I work from home? And that's basically, that'll help you test the waters. It'll also let you find the things that are going to break when you try to do it for real. Because, there's always stuff that comes up that you don't think about. I had a situation this morning, which happens every Tuesday morning at my house because my neighbor changed their yard maintenance team. The company that does that. They have a leaf blower going outside my window at 7:45 in the morning when I have my first call of the day. And you don't know about stuff like that really until you're stuck at home. And so what you do with a test case, just a single day or a half day, is that lets you find those things before they become a problem. Or you find out that, hey, my router's a piece of crap, or my roommate or wife or kid likes to use Netflix and chew up all the bandwidth. And, you find out all those things. The other thing it lets you do is it lets you safely float the idea of remote work without it being having a lot of consequences, for the office, because you're going to be back tomorrow. So at worst, they lost a little bit of productivity. So it makes it a safer bet for your employer to go, yeah, I'll let you work from the house because it's not a permanent thing. So basically, it is a sales process is the way you treat this, right? Like you're escalating what you're selling to the boss. And initially, it's just, hey, I just need to take a day and work from the house for this one-off type scenario. You rinse and repeat on that until you can show that you are more productive at home, which is pretty easy, even under the circumstances like now. I've seen lots of people get substantial increases in productivity just because they're working from home and not getting interrupted. Because, you know, there's always the one guy in the office that, you know, is loud and disturbs everybody else or whatever. So
yeah, that's Tim.
Yeah, I worked with a guy. He was at the other end of the building. Now, granted, it's a small office, but he was so loud that even with headphones on, you could hear him. Like, I had like nice Bose noise canceling headphones, which don't block speech, by the way, anyway, but
right.
You would think with something over your ears, you could at least focus a little bit. And yeah, the guy would interrupt the entire development team to ask one person a question. And you don't have that at home. And so a lot of people are finding that they get a pretty crazy increase in productivity just, you know, from that. It's also interesting how it works out. Like, your manager may suddenly find that, you know, some resources need to be shuffled around a little bit as people start working remote. So where I work, you know, of course, we do a whole bunch of, you know, we're an Angular and .NET shop. But most of, you know, the people that were developers were working in the office, whereas a lot of the QA team had more of a tendency to work from home. Well, they'd already optimized the crap out of their processes. And so when the dev team goes home and suddenly gets more efficient, the QA team gets nailed because they don't have enough staff now, because they, you know, they were basically were functioning at a higher level before, and all of a sudden the load shifted on them. And so this will help you find those kind of things. It's basically a way of reducing the risk for management, you know, all through the process, so that they can say yes to you and that they want to, because they're getting more productivity.
Yeah. Like, I notice sometimes when, like, you know, there's a bug or something and our boss finds it and he's like, you know, he can just walk over and be like, hey guys, can you fix this real quick? So we're like right there and he can kind of like demo it for us, like reproduce the issue for us like right away. So it's kind of like one of those, like, it's kind of like hard when, like, you know, you're working from home right now. We kind of like, we don't have those same, you know, experiences where, like, you know, people are right next to you. You can just ask a question really quick. So it's kind of like, that's like the hard thing for me. I'm kind of getting used to it right now.
Well, now that you mention it too, Ricky, I'm kind of thinking of something I wasn't thinking of before. I think a lot of these conversations are always framed as how, you know, working from home means other people will distract me less. But since you noted that I can be the noisy one sometimes, now I'm kind of thinking, no, there's actually some validity in the idea that working from home might help me stay away from other people who I would be annoying and interrupting throughout the day. So that's actually an interesting point, you know, because I kind of can be that person sometimes where I do want to turn around and, you know, I saw something online and I want to chat with you guys because you guys are my friends too. So I totally get it. There's also this temptation to interrupt other people's workflows. And I guess as developers, we never really think about, we're always thinking about our workflow being interrupted, but not so much other people's too. So
yeah, like, it's really easy just to like spark a conversation up and like start geeking out over something.
An office full of nerds. Like, oh man. Just like getting into, you know, we had a discussion. Of course, this was in a online meeting even, you know, that went off the rails, you know, on like trivia about the A-team. Right. So, you know, like, yeah,
totally right.
Imagine doing that in an office though, where there's 20 other people.
Man, you would get no work done. It's just like conversations after conversations. Yeah.
Especially in our office too, because I mean, we're a video game company, so there's always people kind of around playing video games or talking about video game news. And it's, if you're into that world of topics, it's so easy to just start getting sucked into the vortex of wanting to be included in all of that. So
yeah, it's of course, you know being from more of a JavaScript background, you guys actually probably didn't undergo this shift as much as like desktop developers did in C#. But do you recall a time like when everybody was doing things synchronously in code for the most part, and then all of a sudden they discover async and they're like, oh, this is way better? That's right. Kind of what we have here, right? It's like, okay, I have to ask for stuff before I need it. And me getting that stuff, you know, I'm not going to sit and wait and spin, you know, I'm going to go on and do other things. Well, we're getting that same kind of phase change in our workflows now by having to work remote. You have to prepare before you ask somebody a question, you know, because at the very least, you got to type it out in email just to, you know, to be able to ask it, you know, or you got to ping somebody on chat. And so people are having to prepare more There's also an expectation that comes on management. And this is something that actually makes managers resist remote work a lot more, is that management can't just suddenly interrupt the whole team when they've got a question. It's forcing structure on them. And that's why a lot of them don't like it, frankly, is, you know, they measure performance based on butts and seats. They also tend to interrupt their team a whole lot. And if you suddenly switch to remote work, you can't do that because you don't know that the guy's even there. And this is especially true when you start having time zone differences in the mix too. So when you go remote, you are asking for a very different workflow from everybody. And the assumption tends to be that it will be asynchronous, that things will be documented, and that people will have time to prepare before they answer versus, you know, an interruptive type of workflow.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, I think a lot of companies, especially like what happened recently with COVID-19, they were kind of just like, you know, sprung onto this. Luckily with us, we have like a project manager, we have sprints. So, you know, our bosses know exactly what we're going to be getting done or what we're working on. But I can only imagine like other companies that don't have that structure. They're kind of just like, well, what is this guy working on? Like, why is this taking you longer? Like, cause some projects do take long. But I feel like it could be scary for some, you know, maybe developers when they kind of have to take a little bit of extra time working on certain features because, you know, it just ended up taking longer, and them being scared that their boss is thinking that, you know, they're not getting any work done working from home. And, you know, especially right now, like everything's so new to them. So yeah, like I think having that structure is, you know, something very key to, you know, working remotely.
Yeah. And you brought up another key as well, is that when you do work remote, you have to communicate more.
Yeah, for
sure. Not less. I mean, you got to let them know, hey, look, you know, here's the problem I'm facing. You know, stuff has changed, that, you know, they have to know that. That's one thing that developers really need to do, you know, especially with your project manager, right? Your project manager probably was fairly accustomed to interrupting you to ask on status. Well, now you have the opportunity to go, okay, well, here's where things are. You send them an email and they never interrupt you because they have the information right there. So it's not worth their time. And you just saved yourself a random interruption at some arbitrary point in the day. So it is really a very significant structural change that forces everybody to work in a way that is more efficient for the larger team, not just more efficient for them.
No, yeah, I think communication is a big factor. I know one thing like right now, what's really working out for me is that all the communication right now is happening over our chat. So like, I feel like I'm not missing out on a lot of those conversations. But, you know, previously before all this happened, I would feel like if I were to work from home, because we have that ability to work from home if we wanted to. I was always kind of like worried that like some conversations I was missing out on, like maybe like the team was kind of going over any structure or kind of like just brainstorming over some things. And I wasn't there kind of like to listen, to absorb it, or like to learn from something. And so that's like one of the things that I felt like I was missing out on.
Yeah, that's a tricky one, especially yeah. when half of the people are in the office, right? Because you do miss those conversations. If you want to enable a remote workforce, it has to be, you know, with the assumption that things will be, you know, video conference by default or something, you know, some other means other than face-to-face by default, because otherwise you're establishing tiers among your employees, and the ones that are on the bottom tier, in other words, the people working remote, you know, they tend to lose out over time if you don't structure it that way. It's also really handy from the perspective of certain kinds of personalities in the office. You know, I worked for a company a while back where the main owner would just like some days he was having a real bad day. And when you work remote with somebody like that, you don't get the warnings from other people. Go, hey, you know, Joe is in a really bad mood. You know, watch out today, you know, keep your head down. Like, you don't know that until you're on a call with him and you say something and he explodes.
Oh, right. Wow.
And so yeah. there's a social aspect to this thing that, you know, has to be handled appropriately. Of course, the other thing about that is maybe now he doesn't have as many reasons to be irritated because he's not having to go into the office either. So it, it does shift stuff around, and you are essentially adding a bit of energy to a chaotic system, so you don't know what's going to come out of it.
Right. I find that the whole social aspect of it is so interesting. And when I think about this, I think about me and Ricky have one specific coworker named Gatlin, and he's a core part of our team. And I've actually never met Gatlin. He's always been remote, works over on the other side of the country. And, you know, when you talk about this social aspect, a lot of the time, I think, especially when new people come onto the team, because, you know, Gatlin isn't walking around the office and stuff, they don't really realize how much of a presence he has on our team. Or even just, you know, it's harder to get to know someone when they're remote all the time. So I think on the flip side, you know, we always think about how we as someone remote can make sure, you know, if we're in the remote role, we want to make sure that we're, you know, communicating enough to feel included or to make our presence known. But on the flip side, it's also important that if you're an in-office person, to take the time to include that remote coworker. If you guys do have a little brainstorming session in the office, it's part of your job to go communicate to them and say, hey, like, I need to keep you included. And just let them know what's going on too. And that's part of the cohesion of a team that kind of has like an asymmetrical makeup of working from home or not.
That is absolutely true. I worked on a team where we had a guy that was from Michigan, and he was now living in South America. And I noticed he was talking a lot more in meetings. You know, we had like our morning stand-up, and he was making the meeting run over. You know, he was talking like a dead gum podcaster, you know, he's on there just yammering. And I was like, man, this is kind of weird. And I finally realized what's going on is he's in a foreign country. This is his only chance all day to speak English.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so I called him after hours, and yeah, dude was bored out of his mind. Like, the guy actually built his own forge in his backyard, found sand in the river that had iron in it, that had a lot of iron, smelted it down into pig iron, hammered it out, and made a knife.
Wow.
It's like, that's like medieval level boredom. Right. Okay, we should have probably handled this earlier, you know, and had some just normal conversations with the guy and go, hey, you know, how's it going, you know, and talk about stuff that isn't work related. Because I mean, yeah, he's basically turning into Castaway, you know. And you know, that's a common problem with situations where one or two people are remote and nobody else is. So you really have to watch that.
Right. And you want to keep them a part of your team culture and stuff too. Cause I think, you know, castaway is a good word for it, is if you let someone on your team or you become the castaway, you kind of lose your sense of, cause I've been that person on previous teams I've worked on many years back, where if you start feeling isolated, you start to lose your connection to the team in a way that can make you lose your, you know, desire to stay at the company or to be a part of the project and stuff in ways that you don't expect. You kind of do feel marooned, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and you also tend to misinterpret, right?
Right.
Like the coworkers I have on my team right now, like our entire bunch is a bunch of smart alecks. We just are. It's, yeah. You know, they put us all in one bunch, I guess, to isolate that from the rest of the group. But, if I wasn't, you know, in a situation where I had good rapport with these people, how many things a day that they say would I misinterpret? Just because, you know, we all are kind of the way we are. But if we didn't know each other well, or we had broken that rapport, all of a sudden it would be toxic instead of, oh, yeah, we're just, you know, giving each other crap because that's kind of what we do. And yeah, it's very easy to isolate yourself to a degree that you don't know what's going on, or where you get misinterpreted, or you misinterpret other people, you know. And this goes all the way back. I mean, I remember reading Machiavelli writing in The Prince, you know, about the danger of castles is they make you not understand the common people, right? You're isolated and you're safe and they aren't, and you don't understand what's going on and how much more dangerous that is than anything that the castle is supposed to protect you from. And so isolation is extremely toxic to a team. And yeah, it's something that has to be mitigated. I'll say the other thing too, most of the stuff that we're trying to fix when we work remotely, we have to do it intentionally. We have to do things intentionally that are normally handled by somebody else in an office or by happenstance, right? Because if you have a cube next to somebody, you probably talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the social interaction occurs. Or, you know, if you have a network team and your, you know, your router goes in the blink, well, the developers usually don't have to fix that. I've had to pull cable once or twice in my career, but we won't get into that one. Typically, it's handled by somebody else or happenstance. Whereas when you work remote, it's intentional. You go, okay, I have to have, you know, extra cable. I have to have, you know, a backup router. I have to have communication with my coworkers. I have to over-communicate. You know, I have to make sure that I still build good rapport and that I am a good, you know, good team player to a degree that I probably wouldn't have to do in the office. So it does force a degree of intentionality and just ownership of your work situation on you. And a lot of people are not sufficiently prepared for that.
One of the biggest pain points that I find as I talk to people about software is deployment. It's really interesting to have the conversations with people where it's, I don't want to deal with Docker. I don't want to deal with Kubernetes. I don't want to deal with setting up servers. I don't, you know, all of these different things. And in a lot of ways, DevOps has gotten a lot easier. And in a lot of ways, DevOps has also kind of embraced a certain amount of culture around applications, the way we build them, the way we deploy them. And I've really felt for a long time that developers need to have the conversations with DevOps or adopt some form of DevOps so that they can take control of what they're doing and really understand when things go to production, what's going on, so that they can help debug the issues and fix the issues and find the issues when they go wrong and help streamline things and make things better and slicker and easier so that they'll more generally go right. So we started a podcast called Adventures in DevOps. And I pulled in one of the hosts from one of my favorite DevOps shows, Nell Shamrell Harrington from the Food Fight show. And we got things rolling there. And so this is more or less a continuation of the Food Fight show where we're talking about the things that go into DevOps. So if you're struggling with any of these operational type things, then definitely check out Adventures in DevOps. And you can find it at adventuresindevopspodcast.com.
So kind of going beyond, you know, just how can you, so we're talking about some of the struggles of working from home and everything in terms of communication, but, you know, aside from, yes, you need to communicate a lot more and make sure you remain included and stuff, but what are some strategies that you use to actually make sure that you are getting your work done? Because I know being at home, there's a lot of distractions. You might want to sit and do your laundry, or it's easier to boot up a video game and no one's watching. So how do you kind of steer away from all those temptations and make sure that you still get your stuff done?
Well, there's a couple things. One is to have a routine. So, you know, like I get up at the same time every day. I start doing, you know, certain things at certain times every day. Typically use productivity techniques like the Pomodoro technique to make sure
what's that?
It's a tomato timer. So the guy that came up with this thing actually had a little, I guess it's like a little cooking timer that does like a 25-minute time. And I'm guessing that's for like blanching tomatoes or something, because he's in Italy. So they've got a lot of those over there. But basically he figured out that if he's hyper-focused for 25 minutes, takes a 5-minute break, hyper-focused for 25 minutes, you know, then takes like a, you know, 10 or 15 minute break, you know, that's a good way to break up the day and to ensure that you've got enough periods of extreme focus, you know, because honestly, as a software developer, you don't work 8 hours a day, right? That's not a actual sustainable pace for doing fairly difficult software development. You know, that's a factory worker's schedule, not the reality of what we do. Mm-hmm. So the main thing you got to do is, you know, control it to the degree that you can say, okay, I'm going to have a focused work time during this time period of the day. And that's the only thing I'm going to focus on. I wouldn't worry as much about eliminating the distractions as I would about focusing on being positive towards, you know, actually being productive, because the distractions, you know, will not be as big of a deal if you're actually getting stuff done. It's when you're not getting stuff done and you go, well, I'll just play a game for a minute. And then 5 hours later, you know, you've leveled your mage in World of Warcraft, but you're, right. Yeah, you're not productive.
So how do you, like, I have a question about like what if you're working too much? Like, what's the best way to for me, like I have to tell myself like, okay, not this weekend, I'm not going to work. Because it's so easy, kind of like, oh, you know, I want to get ahead of work and, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, be stressed out. I'm trying to, like, finish this sprint. Do you have any like recommendations on like how, what's the best way to like kind of just like, okay, you know, let me stop working or anything like that?
Well, I'll say this with the caveat that I have a podcast. I wrote 2 books last year and I have a meetup group. And I'm learning Russian. So I'm not exactly the best person to talk to about avoiding overwork because it's sort of my natural state. Although I will say that probably the best thing that I've seen is understanding what the extra work does. It screws up all your timelines. It makes management think you can get more done in less time. I mean, like unless you're reporting the time on the weekend, management thinks, oh, they worked a 40-hour week. Well, you actually worked a 65-hour week. And now management expects 65 hours worth of work to be done in 40.
True, that's right in the butt, yeah.
Yeah. And so if you think about it as, hey, I'm shooting myself in the foot and I'm doing it for no upside to me because I'm not getting paid extra for the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that there's an opportunity cost with the rest of my life, that's typically the way that I characterize it. That's why I was able to write, you know, 2 books, within a year's time is I was like, okay, I've got this extra time. I'm going to capitalize on that for some other opportunity. So sometimes you can just say, okay, I'm going to shift and just work on stuff for me.
Oh yeah. Yes. True.
When you get an extra 2 hours a day that you're not having to be in transit and you're not having to go out to eat lunch because, you know, you mainly just need to get away from the office. You know, when you work from home, you just go get something out of the fridge and, you know, you're back in 20 minutes.
No, yeah.
When you have all that extra time, if you are using that time to your best benefit, it's probably not in your day job.
No, yeah. I think it's been super useful not having to commute and like, you know, same thing with food. You can just cook it here. I do feel like I have more work, more work hours. So I think for me personally, I just need to like structure my day a little bit better. I do feel like I could be overworking sometimes. And I should like learn to like, okay, I've already worked my 8 hours or let's say 8 hours. I need to just kind of stop and work on something for myself or like go meditate or something. Just something totally different. So I'm going to try to add that to my routine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
think more than ever, it's just so important to, cause you know, we're all stuck inside right now. You kind of have a obligation to society to not go outside as much as possible. So it's so important more than ever to take time for yourself and remember that you don't have to be productive 24/7. We're all trying to mentally cope with the situation in the world right now, you know, to varying degrees, depending on how privileged or not privileged you may be. So it's important to take the time to remember it's okay to go play a video game for a while. It's okay to do something that's not necessarily productive toward your career. It's very human to go and take you time, especially right now, because that's what keeps you, you know, mentally sane, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, you can almost look at that as, sharpening the saw, right? Like I know that if I work 80 hours in a week at a development job, which I have done, and that's unfortunate. You know, it was contract work and they were paying me through the nose. So I was, after it was over, the bank account was nice. But if you look at your downtime as, hey, this is a necessary part of me being productive. Like if productivity is your end all be all, like you can still win at this, right? You just go, look, I'm going to play a video game from this time to this time because I know I need downtime for my brain to function effectively. It's just like sleep. It's a physiological need.
Yeah. A lot of time people just forget, like we don't work, for the sake of work. We work to have, you know, a life beyond just our work too. So it's just
right. And honestly, if you've got family and you got kids, they're going to enforce that on you anyway, to some degree.
True. Yeah.
She's not doing it right now, but my daughter, typically would come down and be like, you know, why are you still working? It's pretty good about, you know, calling me on that. Especially if I'm working at, you know, 7 o'clock at night and I've been up since 5:30 that morning. Family is definitely good for that. I think a lot of it too is, people tend to stick into one mode or another. So, they either overwork or they don't work. And part of the problem there is not having a clean separation between things. You know, commutes tend to enforce that. You're getting the car for 30 minutes and there's a clean break between work and home. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you just walk down a flight of stairs and you're in your office, and by the way, that's where you play your video games, that line can get blurry, you know, pretty easily. And so that's one of the places where the power of routine comes in. So that's why I get up at 5:30 in the morning. I don't actually have to be on until about 6:30 because the company I work for is Eastern time zone and I'm in Central. So it's, 7:30 in the morning for them. But having a routine that's like, okay, first thing in the morning, I get up, I walk the dogs, I get my coffee, I get something for breakfast. I check a few things that, I need to do my to-do list, and then I start my day. Doing that every morning essentially establishes a clean break between, okay, I'm at home and now I'm in the office. And I do the same thing at the end of the day. I'll step away from the computer for, 30 minutes and usually go lift weights. Because I basically converted my garage into a home gym right after we moved into this house. And so I got a, squat rack, bench press, I got a bunch of different kettlebells. And so I go do that. And then I can come back to my desk, and even though it's the same desk, now it doesn't feel like a work environment. It feels like, okay, this is where I get my stuff done, or I play games or whatever. Having those clean breaks really puts a limit on either overwork or underwork, by demarcating the different zones, essentially.
I really relate to the exercise thing too. For me, that's huge, especially now just being trapped inside all the time. It's so important to move, move your body, get some of that energy out. It's just so healthy and good for you. It helps your mood so much. So like in the home gym is so underrated. People don't realize just how much you can do. I saw significant progress, with like a really junky bench, a pull-up bar and some free weights and yoga mat, and you can really go a long way. So I'd suggest everyone, especially right now, you really don't need an expensive buy-in to be productive in terms of exercise. And it really does. It's a good clean break for sure. 100%. I use it too at the end of my day to kind of split my work time from my leisure time.
I would also say another thing that's really important is managing your sleep cycles and your attentiveness cycle during the day. So, a lot of people think they're not morning people, and they actually are, but they don't get enough sleep at night because they stay up till 1, and then try to get up at 7. Oh, I'm not a morning person. It's like, dude, you didn't sleep. Getting that under control and actually testing out to figure out when you are most productive is extremely valuable. Because I know that I write my best code from about 6 to 6:30 in the morning until probably about 10 o'clock in the morning. And then I have another window between about 3:30 in the afternoon and 8 o'clock at night. But there's that chunk of time around lunch where I'm basically illiterate as far as my code sucks if I write it during that time period. And so I try not to code during that window. I try to work on documentation, schedule meetings. I can QA stuff because I'm basically in a user's mental state. But figuring out which tasks belong in which part of the day will make you more effective as well, because you really don't need an 8-hour day to get 8 hours worth of work done. Yeah.
The sleep thing is interesting to me too, because I agree. You need like a good maybe 8 hours is too much for some people, but I need like 8 hours to function. But I've just come to terms with the idea that I'm never going to be a morning person. I wish I could wake up early. I wish I could go to bed early, but I think just certain people biologically are just prone to needing to stay up late and wake up later. So for me, luckily we have a work culture where that's actually a little bit flexible. And because our managers trust us to get our work done, no one's ever said anything to me about it. But I tend to get out of bed at like 10. And then even back when we were able to access the office, I kind of come in late and I push to see how far I could do that. But as long as you're getting your work done, as long as you find the sleep schedule that works for you, as long as you still get the correct window of sleep, no matter where your window kind of rests, is the important thing to figure out for sure. But it can be hard too for me because, then you have to just be aware some people might be more available in the morning, and when it's 5 and you're still going because you started later, they're going to check out, and just to be aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, that is one thing I'm lucky on, is that work actually sent me a laptop. And so I have my desktop, you know, to my left, my work machine to the right, and they're both shared on, you know, with a KVM switch. And so all I got to do is hit the button and I'm on my personal machine. One thing I do tend to do in the evenings, if I'm at the computer and I'm working on my stuff, which is most of them right now, I do keep my work laptop open, and that way I can handle pull requests and that kind of stuff. If, you know, somebody is working, you know, burning the midnight oil, because we've got a couple of them on our team that do that. You know, they kind of come in late and then they work late, and that way I can facilitate them getting stuff done and they aren't clogging the build pipeline for me in the morning with their PRs. So, you know, you can kind of get a little bit of a hybrid approach. I try not to over focus on it, but I will leave the laptop open just so that, you know, cause it's only a couple of minutes to look at the code and, you know, get things moving for them. And you can really add a lot of efficiency to the team doing things that way and not really have a time expenditure that's, you know, very substantial.
Unless it's like a 5,000 line pull request or something like that.
Oh, well, yeah. The trick with that is you hit the Windows key and the L key and your workstation's locked and it shows you as offline, and they're like, oh, he missed it, he'll have to get it in the morning. And then you have a team lead who gets up a little bit earlier than you because he's on Eastern time and it's his problem. Yeah, I already got that one figured out, man.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I'm real good at dodging big honking pull requests.
Kind of on the topic of like notifications too, I guess one thing that I wish people would do, especially as like teams desynchronize in terms of like their time windows, especially with remote work and stuff, is just realize your Slack has settings for, you know, like, what's the mode called when you're not available?
It's away or right. Inactive.
So there's ways to set it where you won't get notifications to your phone during certain windows. So sometimes I might fire out a message late at night because I want to get it out of my brain and get it to the person before I go to sleep and forget about it or something. And usually when I do that, I'm expecting you to, you know, you don't have to reply. It's okay. I know that it's like 8 p.m. or something, and I'm not actually expecting a reply, but, you know, if that window of time doesn't work for you to reply, then, you know, set your notifications up so that you don't get bothered when something like that happens. It's totally okay. You can get to it in the morning. And I think that, you know, goes with remote and different time zones and all this stuff is.
Yeah. Time zones are awful. Especially in, I recently had some work stuff involving JavaScript dealing with time zones anyway. And just with, server crap and just how nasty it is to get computers to play nice with that. And now we add people into the mix. you know, if your team is distributed across, you know, even, you know, just two time zones, right? Every time zone you add essentially takes an hour off the beginning of the day and the end of the day where all your team is in the office. And it also increases the width of the lunch break as well. And so when you start getting, you know, three or four time zones, you'll have a dynamic develop where a team will schedule something like right after their lunch and it's right in the middle of some other dude's lunch. And management has to be really careful in that circumstance because if they go, well, they can schedule the meeting at this time, you're essentially saying, hey, the other employees are a lower tier, you know, they're lower priority people because we're fine with screwing up their lunch break, but we're not going to screw up these other guys' lunch break. And so there's a lot of interpersonal stuff that starts hitting when you have the time zone stuff in the mix. I did cover that in the book, you know, going, hey, look at, you know, if you start getting three or four time zones, you know, now it's almost impossible to get everybody in the same office at the same time. You know, you have just a really narrow meeting of meeting window where everybody's available. And you start getting, you know, 10, 12 hour difference. Now the only meetings you can have happen are at the worst possible time for everybody. It's either early in the morning or late at night. I've had the life experience of working with a group of software developers who were scattered all over the planet. And it was, you know, it was a bunch of Russians. And so I was getting on a phone call at 5:15 in the morning and listening to three distinct Russian accents. And this is before I started learning the language. Right. So they're speaking in English. And then there was a guy that was in Northern India, and there was a guy in somewhere in Indonesia, and I can't remember exactly where. And so you're having to listen to all three of those, you know, or all three of the Russian accents plus the other two disparate accents, plus my hillbilly accent, plus a Mississippi hillbilly's accent, which is completely different. You know, he kind of had the mumble mouth thing going at 5:15 in the morning. And man, you talk about a nightmare trying to communicate. I mean, it might as well have been different languages because, you know, we wouldn't hear words the same. You know, we didn't understand intonation of the other person. You know, people would make jokes and nobody would laugh. I mean, that's a real thing when you spread stuff out over enough time zones. Like, it has to be managed pretty intentionally.
So how did you guys manage that? Like, what was your time
poorly.
Zone?
yeah, I was up at, you know, 5:15 in the morning for these calls. And honestly, I had more trouble with the guy from Mississippi understanding his accent than I did the Russians. Yeah, because, I mean, just, hey, man, you know, you're like, I could deal with the Russian accents and the, you know, the Southeast Asian accent and the Indian accent fairly well. But the Mississippi one was messing me up pretty bad.
This is interesting. It's actually kind of applicable to stuff that I see in the office because, you know, we're based in LA and then we have remote workers over in a lot of North Carolina. Our QA team is, I think, somewhere in Georgia, like Atlanta or something. Then we recently, our department was consumer technology, and we recently got like reorged as a part of this bigger organization called Demonware that Activision owns, and they do a bunch of our backend stuff, and they're based in Dublin. I also think they have an office in Eastern Canada. Then at the same time, we interact with Tencent, who's all based out of China. So you see a lot of, I see stuff where coworkers have to coordinate meetings at 3 a.m. with China because they're very strict on just when they'll be available. So it can get a little extra sometimes managing all that for sure.
Many of you have probably heard about App Store optimization and how it can help you get more downloads. There's a lot of demand for apps right now, so it's a really great time to give it a try. It's easier than you think. The folks at AppFigures have easy step-by-step guides and intuitive tools, which many indie developers are using to get more downloads. The guys who run it are indie devs who have a need and created the tool. 11 years later, it's an all-in-one platform for developers who want to get more downloads and make more money with their apps. Try AppFigures for free, and if you like it, you can use our special code RNR3030 to get 30% off for the next 3 months.
Yeah, there's also a trick with accents, which I kind of picked up. I'm not exactly sure where I picked this up, but if you're working with somebody who has a wildly disparate accent, especially if they spoke another language first, a lot of times one thing that will help is just learning some common phrases in their language. Not because you're going to use those common phrases, but because it will show you how they pronounce certain sounds. And it makes it where your ear can hear it. And you'll actually pick it up in English when they're talking in English better. I've noticed that with like really thick Russian accents, you know, having learned, you know, just the first few weeks of learning that language, I was able to pick up when a Russian was speaking English and understand them better because I'd learned a little bit of their language.
This is great. This is like the kind of deep nugget tip that you really just don't think about. And I like the idea of people going out of their way to learn other people's culture too. So that's a great tip, actually.
Yeah. Now, I will say this, if you're working with people from India, one thing that a lot of Americans, there's several things that a lot of Americans don't realize is they tend to learn English, you know, pretty well if they're working with Americans anyway, but their source language, you know, there's a whole bunch of different languages there. You know, we tend to, in American culture, we tend to think of languages or cultures as being kind of, a single monolith, whereas most other countries don't. You know, they have a wide variety of languages there. So, like in India, you know, you have Tamil and you have is it Tagalog, you have Hindi. You know, you've got a pretty broad band of dozens of languages, and so you may need to think about, you know, you may want to ask the coworker, you know, where they're from in that country, and then learn a little bit about. You know, the area that they come from. It's also it's also really neat when you can have conversations with the coworkers at a, you know, at a frequency and depth where you start to get a little bit of a cultural exchange going on. So like, you know, I worked with a bunch of folks from India at one of my previous jobs, and they had a kind of like a pre Diwali meal. Mm-hmm. And like, it was me and all of them went to this Indian restaurant, and they ordered for me because I, you know, the menu that came out was like a special, you know, menu for that. And it wasn't in English. And that was like one of the coolest things. And they were just laughing at me because I was like just dredging through hot sauce and just.
That sounds cool.
It's such a great rapport builder. Like, yeah. I think a lot of times we tend to go, hey, people are different. And we gloss over that fact and we don't realize what a strength that is, right? Yeah. Because I can learn something from you. You can learn something from me. And I might find, you know, some kind of food that I really like or some cultural practice that I think is really relevant. And I can take that and run with it. Remote work, by the way, enables that, right? Because now I can have a team all over the planet. I can have people with really, really different life backgrounds, and I can have them in the same room and working together in a cooperative sense to build something. One of the things I've worked with remote workers is, you know, some of them, you know, they've got kids with medical issues and they can't go into an office because they need to be close to the house. Or, you know, they have a medical issue, or, you know, they live way out in the sticks somewhere, or they live in, you know, Ecuador, and you just get like a much broader and more valuable kind of diversity, right? Like it's the kind that, hey, we can actually get something from each other versus the kind that gets artificially introduced by HR departments where they create friction because it's not real diversity. It's like a forced thing. Mm-hmm. When you let it develop organically or you intentionally as a group try to communicate better, you just get really, really amazing results. You know, it's when people say, hey, diversity really helps, like that's what they're talking about. I honestly think we could really improve the way a lot of workplaces work and a way a lot of people interact with a remote, you know, work environment. It's a lot bigger than just, oh, I want to work from home so I don't have a commute. It's like, no, this changes everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a really good point, actually. A lot of companies, there's so much value in adding diversity to your company. It's just proven, it's factual. And I think, you know, one way to do that is a lot of marginalized individuals or individuals who wouldn't have the opportunity to, you know, maybe uproot and move to LA or something and just assimilate into LA culture. You're really inviting individuals to come and be a part of your team and contribute their culture, their diversity, while also understanding that to have access to that diversity, you need to work around their remote situation and why they need to be remote. And that actually makes a lot of sense and is super cool. I think that's one of the most profound arguments for building a more remote team is to embrace that level of diversity you can achieve.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the ways to sell it to a lot of the bigger companies, right? Because they do, you know, they do value that. And a lot of times in their local area, they can't find anybody to hire under those circumstances. Like I'm in Nashville and now it's changed quite a bit, but like 15 years ago, they all looked and talked like me. You know, that's the kind of IT people we mostly had. And so if a company was like, hey, I want to hire more African-American software developers, or I want to hire more Hispanic software developers, or I want to hire, you know, somebody who, you know, has a different linguistic background. That wasn't particularly doable in Nashville, but it was doable if you could say, okay, I'm going to send some of the work, you know, even just as short of a distance as to Atlanta. It, you know, is vastly different because there, you know, there was a strong base of African-American software developers there that wasn't here. Now it is here too. So they, you know, that's kind of organically fixed itself. But for, you know, for a lot of companies, you know, that's a very valid way to, you know, get around this. The other thing it lets them do is it lets them hire people a lot of times at a pay scale that is more reasonable. For instance, if, you know, the company I work for is actually in a small town in Indiana, and I'm in a big city in Tennessee. So it's not not as much of a difference. But somebody in like the Bay Area could hire a, you know, a senior software developer in Nashville for a lot cheaper. Right. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head what like a senior C# developer's salary is in the Bay Area, but in Nashville, it's right at 100K. Mm-hmm. And in the Bay, like that's poverty wages just about.
Yeah. It's so expensive over there. So it's like the wages are so different. Or you can luck out too. And you start off in the Bay and you move to Nashville and you're like pocketing big money.
So. Yeah, there's a lot of that. yeah, there's been a fair bit of that happening too. It lets your employees move around. It means that, you know, let's say that you have a great employee and her husband gets a job opportunity at some company halfway across the country. Well, if you don't allow remote work, you're going to lose that employee through really no fault of your own. But if you do allow it, all of a sudden now I have an employee who's gone across the country. They're extremely loyal to me because I've created this opportunity for them. Right. And they didn't have to have a fight with their, you know, their spouse about whether we keep your job or we take this new opportunity. Right. It's like we can do both.
Yeah. Just so true.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing I think a lot of employers don't really realize is you have more power in the situation by not asserting your power in the situation.
Right. Yeah.
It's like dating.
Yeah. Right?
Like if the guy that's possessive of the girl isn't going to keep the girl and, you know, he sucks as a boyfriend. He's a terrible person. Right. And if you look at employment in that kind of sense, it's like, hey, I'm giving my employees the opportunity, you know, if a better job comes up and they want to take it, great. But that's like a total confidence power move there, right? Like you're like, yeah, but I know I got my ducks in a row and this is the better deal. And I'm going to make sure it's a better deal. That makes everything better for everybody all around. And you don't have to have these power games. And remote work is kind of part of that, right? It's saying I don't have to look over my employee's shoulder all the time because I trust them to do their job. And because you do that, you can now trust them to do their job.
All right. So switching gears just a little bit, and I'm going to get a little bit meta on you, Will. One thing that's super cool to me is that you wrote a book. That's awesome. And I guess kind of zooming out a little bit, what advice could you give, or what's it like to be a software developer writing your own book and releasing it? Because I know a lot of listeners are probably thinking this is something that they'd want to do someday, or they're into blogging and stuff. So what kind of advice or insight can you give?
I would honestly say just make sure that you have targeted something that's a problem. So like my whiteboard interview book, which was the first one, I was initially speaking at Nashville Software School, helping those students get prepared for whiteboard interviews. And that happened because I was helping a friend who went through there get prepared for whiteboard interviews. And she mentioned me to them. And I was helping that friend because I helped another friend who's my partner on the podcast when he was getting into software development. Basically the deal is you start, you know, start developing small things, and look at, like, I think a lot of people have a backward view of what creativity is. You don't hunt ideas, you bait them. And what I mean by that is you get a few ideas and you use those as your entry fee to get in front of people who will give you better ideas.
Makes sense.
And so that's kind of the way I approach that is I did the talk at Nashville Software School, you know, over and over again, did it three or four times. And this dude goes, hey, is there a book that helps prepare for whiteboard interviews? I'm like, I don't know. And I went and looked and I didn't see one. And so I was like, well, crap, I'll write one. And I self-published and, initially, and then A-Press contacted me like a week after the book went live on LeanPub. And they're like, hey, we're really interested in this. We'd like to publish under our brand. And I'm like, well, they've got more than a $5 marketing budget, you know, so they're doing better than me. So why not? And I had to expand it a bunch, but that's how that started, right? I didn't go hunt an idea. I had a little bit of an idea and I got it in front of people and I used that interaction to drive that.
You just have to like listen, kind of see what's going on. And then like, if you just kind of stop and pause and kind of see and listen, you can kind of see like, oh, there's this problem here and let me see what I can do about that.
Yeah. And you guys are podcasters too. So, the same thing. You'll have listeners that'll go, hey, what about this? Right. People start pinging you with questions about stuff. Any audience of a sufficient size is indistinguishable from having actual creativity.
Right.
Because the ideas will show up just because you're having the interaction.
So we're running out of time a little bit. So in a second, we'll move on to our sick picks. But this is such an interesting topic, the topic of self-publishing a book and writing books about software. I almost feel like we'd need to have you on for a second episode where we can just dive into that whole process. And
I can give you a synopsis real quick.
Sure.
It's good scotch. good scotch, death metal, and nice. You know, doing something every day on it.
All right.
Yeah.
I need the full blog post, and I need it just to be titled Scotch, Death Metal, and Writing or something.
Yeah. It just seems like that, you know, something where you can't completely understand all the words, but it's fast. there's something to that. And that was basically my process on both of those books. Now, I didn't drink the scotch every day because I'm cheap. That was more for like open-ended, like I really need to get a bunch of stuff done real quick. But yeah, the writing is usually not the hard part. The part that's hard is sticking with it and maybe the ideation, like breaking it into ideas that you can actually work with. So yeah, cool. I'd totally be willing to jump on and have that conversation. That'd be cool.
Yeah, we can talk about that a little more after the show. So moving on to picks, for our listeners who don't know what picks are, it's just kind of, you know, not necessarily related to programming or React Native. It can be if we want it to be. But it's just stuff that, you know, we've been watching or doing lately that we kind of want to shout out. So I guess I'll kick it off. My pick this week is a television show called Counterpart. Actually, our designer at work, his name is Alex. So Ricky knows him. He's the one who recommended it to me. And it's called Counterpart. And it's, so I've been watching it on Amazon. I guess you can just watch it for free if you have Amazon Prime or whatever. I think it's originally a Starz show. And I will get I'll say a little bit of spoilers. It's not revealing too much. It's something that they reveal in the first 20 minutes. And I think it's worth spoiling to give you the hook for why you should watch this show. But basically, J.K. Simmons is the main actor. And he works in this government facility for like 30 years. And one day he gets invited into a meeting where he meets a carbon copy of himself, hence the show name Counterpart. The counterpart is from an alternate universe to his. And there's kind of some crossover going on between the two universes. They've diverged to some level. And it almost has like an espionage feel to the whole show, and it took me by surprise how interesting the show actually is. So definitely check that one out. Ricky, what's your pick this week?
So I actually have two picks. My first one is going to be Purple Carrot. It's a food subscription service. So they kind of just give you a bunch of different ingredients and a list of, you know, how to put it together. And it's kind of fun because you get to cook with, cook. And it actually really helps because I don't have to go to the grocery store that much. My second pick is going to be React Navigation version 5. I've been messing around with it for like the last 2 weeks during the weekend. So at work we use version 3, and we're going to soon upgrade. And so I've been kind of testing out version 5. And it's really nice. So it kind of goes away from anything below version 5. It uses the kind of like a object config format to setting up your navigation system. And so with version 5, you actually get to use JSX. So like you kind of start off with like React hooks. So you can actually get access to anything. Like if you have a state management with like Redux or anything like that, you get direct access. A couple of things change, but it's not too bad. But I really like the move that they did, kind of moving from like the different formats. So that's my two picks for this week.
Yeah, you really had to show me, Ricky, how, you know, because I'm gonna be dealing with that soon too. And I know you tend to be kind of like the pathfinder on a lot of new stuff. So you have to update me on how we're going to integrate some of that navigation 5 into our code base. I'm super curious.
No, yeah. I'll I'll catch you up to speed. And it's actually really easy to like, I mean, it's just basically like a component. That's how it really looks like. So it's actually really easy to convert over.
Cool. Sounds nice. Maybe we can do a full episode on migrating from 4 to 5 too. I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in that.
No, for sure.
Awesome. Will, what picks do you have this week for us?
Well, mine is Microsoft Teams. That app has helped so much, especially as we have transitioned to working remotely, because the Active Directory tie-in and all that kind of stuff, being a Microsoft shop. But we figured out how to put custom background images in there. And that has been the most fun thing to mess with for our team. Like it's just, there's been so much rapport built, I think. You know, we got on a meeting with our boss and we all changed our background to a picture of him from his Facebook page and then shut off our cameras. So like he pops on and there's 5 of him, but the thing is he changed his to his boss to mess with us. And so we pop on and we're like, oh wow, we all think the same. I think that is a completely underrated feature in Teams that, like legitimately letting people kind of anonymize out their background. Like mine is kind of boring here. But at work, I can have a picture of me standing in front of Mount Doom as my background. And I really think that is extremely valuable for teams, just in the sense that it lets people personalize and they're also not having to scramble around to clean up the area behind them before they get on a call with their boss.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah. I saw one where a guy was in like a fighter jet and he had 2 fighter jets flying behind him and he had these sunglasses on too. And he was like sipping his coffee in this fighter jet. And I was like, that's actually kind of awesome.
Yeah. Although it does have some weird artifacts because like the way it does face detection and then says, okay, I guess it detects the edge. And so like with a black shirt on in my chair, it does some weird stuff. And so like I could turn my head the wrong way and it like cuts off part of my face, which it's really strange.
Right.
But it's still like, that is the coolest thing. Like you think about, we would have never envisioned that being a thing that would happen, 10 years ago.
That's so true. Yeah.
That even that we'd be having a video call about this, right? Like it would be telephone or maybe Skype, but reliability was crap. And I mean, and we're like living in the Jetsons age right now.
Yeah.
Except for the flying cars.
Yeah, true. Okay. So, hey, Will, where can people find you and kind of get in touch with you?
The best way is probably through Complete Developer Podcast. That's the podcast we have every week. You can send an email actually to get a hold of me, neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com.
Awesome.
Yeah. We did that to be cutesy early on and now we're stuck with that email address. That's probably the easiest way, to find me is, directly through the podcast. Cause I'm obviously sitting here with Outlook open and I'll get an email.
Great.
Comes in. So.
Yeah. And where should people be looking out for? And if you want to reiterate the name of your book too, where can people be looking out for that?
Sure. It's Remote Work, The Complete Guide. Probably the best way to get in the loop on that is to go to simpleprogrammer.com and then search for Remote Work or William Gantt. You can see all the chapter blog posts and a bunch of other stuff on that website. And there'll be a sign up there.
Great.
You can actually find the ones, the chapters that are most relevant to you and your position. So
cool. Sounds perfect. And Ricky, where can listeners find you at?
They can find me on Twitter, at Romero Ricky IO.
Cool. And listeners, if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter as well. It's Tim Jung Dev. Okay, well, that kind of concludes the episode. Thank you, Ricky. Thank you, Will, for joining us today. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Take care. We'll see you next week.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.